Hello and welcome to another Physical Activity and Wellbeing in Education podcast episode with me, Kate Stevenson, Education Advisor and Physical Education Specialist in County Durham. We continue our PE School Sport Physical Activity and Wellbeing Dialogue today with another one of our delightful guests. Hello listeners, today I am joined by my esteemed colleagues from Durham University, Dr. Patrick Zakira and Dr. Mary Hanley and master student Esther Waddington. In this episode, they're going to tell you a little bit about their backgrounds, experience and work within autism, and in particular, their current research studies involving autistic children and young people and autistic adults with regards to physical activity and sport. The National Autistic Society describes autism as, and this is a quote, a lifelong developmental disability that affects how people perceive the world and interact with others. Autistic people see, hear and feel the world differently to other people. And this may, of course, impact on their experience of play and physical activity from an early age, and participation in sport and physical education throughout life. Latest figures, guys, estimate there are 700,000 autistic adults and children in the UK, approximately 1% of the population. That I've taken from the published material in the National Strategy for Autistic Children, Young People and Adults 2021 to 2026. And we can discuss those figures and what we feel about them as we go on. So today, Patrick, Mary and Esther are going to open discussions around barriers to participation in physical activity and sport for those individuals with an autism spectrum disorder, and encourage our listeners perhaps to reflect upon how we as educators in schools and settings, or those of us working with adults or youngsters in the community, provide an inclusive provision for such individuals and groups to access physical education, sport and physical activity. So I'm going to start with Patrick. Patrick, would you mind introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your experience within the world of education and research?
Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for having me today. I'm Patrick Zakira, an assistant professor at Durham University in the Department of Sport and Exercise Sciences. My journey in this world actually started as a physical educator. So I did my undergraduate degree in physical education, and it was kind of in my practicum year where we had a lot of autistic children in a class that I was in that weren't participating. What was challenging was this kind of pervasive, you know, fear amongst some of our teachers who were like, we don't know how to engage them. They don't want to participate. This is really hard. There's often meltdowns. And so I was kind of like, I like challenging behaviors. I love physical activity. I mean, that's been a big part of my life, and let's see what I can do about it in a research context. So my doctoral research in Toronto, Canada, looked at how do we support autistic children and youth in physical activity settings broadly, but also physical education. And now since coming to the UK, I've been looking at more so autistic adults. So trying to take a more of a life course approach, because we know that autistic children become autistic adults. And I think if we're going to develop supports and kind of inclusive approaches, we have to look at the lifespan as a whole. So that's my background. Thrilled to be here today. And thanks so much for having me again.
You're very welcome. And I'm sure your contribution to our discussion here is going to be vital. You've touched on a really significant point there about the life cycle, you know, and the, from diagnosis or not, a child is living with autistic tendencies, and how us as educators support a child through into young adulthood, and indeed how us as a community understand and support autistic children to function normal in normal society, because for them there's no differences there to what their perception is. They've always been autistic. And forgive me if I'm not using appropriate language here, and you can correct me. But there's often a stigma, isn't there, around misinterpretation of a child, for instance, and how they present their understanding of themselves and the world around them as misbehavior, for instance. And you mentioned there about the fear of how to teach appropriately and ensure all individuals, neurodivergent, SEND and disability, or including gifted and talented, are appropriately supported to engage across education and indeed physical activity and physical education in particular for health and well-being agendas. Mary, I'm going to bring you in here as well, because obviously I start to go down that route into children in particular. And I know your work with Esther, who's also on the call with us today, focuses around schools and settings too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, firstly, just thanks very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here today and have the chance to discuss some of these things that obviously I'm very interested in. So I'm a developmental psychologist, and I'm an academic. So like Patrick, I'm based in Durham University. Unlike Patrick, I'm in the Department of Psychology. And I'm also one of the co-directors for a Centre for Neurodiversity and Development. So along with my colleague, Professor Debbie Risey, we've set up a research centre within Durham University, which very much focuses on understanding a lot of the issues that you've already raised about how we can understand strengths and difficulties for neurodivergent children and young people, and how we can develop the appropriate supports to help those children and young people thrive. As you say, a lot of my work has focused on children and young people in relation to educational settings. So again, with Debbie and with our students and fellow researchers in the centre, for a long number of years now, we've been doing research that has been about trying to understand engagement and learning, particularly for autistic children and young people. Now, a lot of that work, and certainly my background isn't physical activity, so actually a lot of that work has really been focused on understanding things like attention in the classroom, sensory arousal in the classroom, and anxiety in the classroom. And I should say that it's from that work that we have developed a particular package of support for teachers that we call AAA. So we've developed a support package that's really accessible to teachers and educators around how to support children and young people, particularly autistic children and young people who experience difficulties with AAA issues at school. And that's really where my interest in physical activity at school has come from, because it's been through doing this work on AAA, so issues around attention, sensory arousal and anxiety, through talking to teachers and parents and young people, that we've heard a lot about particular barriers and issues with accessing PE at school. So, you know, briefly that, for example, if you're somebody who has sensory issues, getting changed for PE actually can act as a barrier to partaking in PE. If you're somebody who is very anxious, you might be somebody who struggles with unpredictability and uncertainty. And actually a PE lesson can bring a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unpredictability in a way that maybe some other lessons might not. So very briefly, that's kind of who I am, what I do, and my sort of segue into why I've become interested in understanding physical activity and PE at school for autistic young people.
Thank you so much, Mary. And you've mentioned there, obviously, that you know, supporting children across all areas of academia and school and what have you, but how challenging physical education is for the teacher to actually deliver appropriate physical education to be inclusive of all children, and how children access that. And the sporting environment, and what comes to mind is the swimming pool in particular. We know ourselves how noisy that environment is, and how a sports hall echoes. If I'm doing training with adults, teaching staff and what have you in a sports hall, that throwback of my own voice, we hear it enough, can be overloading, actually, and very difficult for anyone to kind of concentrate or engage. And I've got to be very mindful of how I project my voice, for instance. But that whole sporting environment, that sensory overload, auditory, the sounds, the smells, the visual and the tactile aspects of doing the physical activity too, can be hugely challenging. You mentioned P-Kit, for instance, too. I know I work with my secondary P department staff across the county. We've talked about barriers to inclusion and things and how the noise of a sports hall can really affect children's engagement. But we also have talked about, you know, how staff can, for instance, overcome the small changes can make a big difference for children and young adults in schools. For instance, having staff think about doing sort of a sensory audit of their facility. So is there a window that's creaky all the time that they haven't noticed, but your student notices? And that is that one little thing that could make a big difference to them being able to concentrate or engage more appropriately. Or, you know, is there some aspect of insulation and padding that prevents that echoing of the sports hall? Or can some aspects of the lessons be delivered within the classroom environment before they go into the larger facility? All of these small little changes can make a huge difference, can't they?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And certainly from the AAA work that we've done today, so thinking about learning in the classroom as opposed to PE necessarily, I think there's a few key messages really that we try to get across from that, which resonate with what you've just said. And they are really about how everybody's different, everybody's an individual, and in fact, different is normal. We really need to change our mindset from, you know, different is something atypical or there's something wrong with being different to different is normal. And let's normalize trying to be inclusive for everybody's individual strengths and difficulties. We also need to really understand the and focus on the environment and what the environment brings to allowing somebody to thrive, because yes, we also need to understand individual strengths and difficulties for sure. But I think we've had too much focus on that up until this point. And actually, we now need to do an awful lot more to understand the impact of the environment. And certainly our work in classrooms and learning speaks to how important the environment can be and how many barriers the environment, the physical environment, the sensory environment can really provide for children and young people. There's a social relational model of disability that underpins our work, which really says that it's the mismatch between a person's skill set and the environment that creates disability. And that really underpins our thinking in the work that we do. And the final point really is what you spoke about, Kate, just there, which is that small changes can make a big difference. And we know that from talking to autistic young people about the kind of small changes that really can make a really significant difference for them. Changes that aren't often costly, don't cost a lot of money. They just need the understanding, the awareness and the willingness, really, I think, to be flexible about how we, you know, in as much as we can, to be flexible about how we deliver, whether it's our, you know, English, Math and Science curriculum or whether it's our PE curriculum, just to have that flexibility. Small changes can make a big difference.
Absolutely. I was discussing this with a few colleagues around inclusion and what have you, and you know, we always seek models of good practice. But actually, we also need to recognise that those models may not work for our particular groups of children or our particular individuals. So having that flexibility, as you've mentioned, and being seeking student voice and letting them be the core creators of your curriculum. We talk about that a lot across everything. And it's quite difficult to get that balance, isn't it? I was thinking that actually educators are having to be almost scientific researchers in that to help, as well as seek student voice, they're also trying a little bit of trial and error to see what works well for those groups or those individuals, but also without creating too much change. So if you go try to change your environment too much, for instance, the facilities or whatever, that actually that could have a more detrimental effect on that student's engagement and ability to participate. So it's about almost controlling variables and changing that one thing and seeing if that has supported the youngster or not. Would you agree, Mary, Patrick?
Yeah. Patrick, do you want to come in there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, it's recognizing, you know, I think teachers are superheroes, honestly, without capes. There's so many demands of being a modern day educator, right? No longer are you just instructing. You are now a care provider. You're providing social emotional support for our students. And, you know, when Mary said, you know, we're not here to add more work. We're trying to work with the existing kind of skill sets and abilities and opportunities. I think that's the biggest key, especially in an environment where, you know, sometimes it's that little modification that actually might work for just a child, but not only them. It might actually work for several students without necessarily having a label, right? So, you know, one way that I've worked with some educators is to try to sometimes reframe kind of what we used to call special education kind of teaching to just good teaching practice, right? So if we're in a gym and, for example, you know, it's a habit to use our whistle and to blow that whistle to stop a play, but we know that that might cause an entire meltdown for some of our kids. But that equally can be distracting for other kids, right? So it's trying to come to terms with, you know, small bits of teaching practice that we're used to, that we take for granted. You know, if we're teaching physical education, it's probably because we like it. It's probably because we're successful at it. And it's keeping that piece in mind that not everyone has had that kind of formative experience. So again, to include our children when we can, how we can, but even to have that small mind, that mind shift where one small kind of adaptation, we can't do it all, right? Again, teachers, I would say, are overburdened now more than ever, and finding ways to support them along the way, along with the students, should be, I think, our top priority from, you know, the research end through to the implementation end, and to also, again, giving the kids the best possible opportunity for all kids to thrive in a physical education setting.
Absolutely. Sport England, for instance, funding for secondary schools has looked at has focused upon improving participation for secondary age students, thinking about the barriers to participation and looking at how to improve the perceptions of students about physical education and school sports, so making experiences more enjoyable and fun and appropriate to needs. So all of this fits into all of that. So there has been funding for secondary colleagues to look at their own CPD and development to raise awareness across school, not just in their P department, for instance, or to create projects to seek student voice, or to create what, as we did with Education Durham, is we supported schools to build projects for change, basically, looking at targeted individuals who were previously disengaged, seeking their voice, looking at ways of promoting physical activity through other ways. So being creative often, or raising awareness, as we should for every child and young adult, about the importance of physical activity. So when we're thinking of autism and or inclusivity across everything, that actually we know from research that physical activity reduces anxiety, that supports our health, mental health and well-being, and we want our students to engage and understand that, and we want to have it valued in our schools as well. So we talk about, as you've said, that actually having inclusive practice, seeking student voice, adapting and supporting, being flexible in an approach, being creative often with our curriculum and our extracurricular provision to improve engagement is good practice. So you're absolutely right that part of initial teacher training, part of funding and support and opportunities for continual professional development is all about raising awareness. It's all about giving us the tricks of the trade and the tools to be strong educational practitioners, strong teachers and teaching assistants to actually meet the needs of all children. Going back to your research that you're working on, and I've talked there a little bit about, well, quite a bit about student voice, pupil voice, and seeking the opinions, the perceptions, the motivations of our youngsters. How have you both gone about your research in collating that data, if you like, from our youngsters? Mary, do you want to come in with yours, and Esther perhaps talk about your recent research and what, how you've engaged with some of the youngsters in our schools?
We have to. So we are in the midst of a project which is a collaboration with County Durham Sports. And when I say we, I am talking about myself, I'm talking about Esther, who I'm sure will be happy to speak in a minute, and also Dora Sadler, who's another master's student with us in the Department of Psychology. And we've been really looking to understand barriers and facilitators to accessing PE at school for autistic young people aged 12 to 17. So these are secondary school aged young people. County Durham Sport came to us and said, look, we'd really like your help to understand some of these barriers, and we think your AAA work might help us to understand this. And so we started off by really looking in the literature as to what was out there. You know, what was out there about, we know the literature tells us that participation in physical activity is significantly reduced among the autistic population compared to the general population. But when it came to finding evidence about what's going on at school, and particularly in a UK context, we found actually there was very little evidence out there. And so really then we decided that the best question to ask was, well, what are the barriers? What is the situation with PE schools to young people? And we decided to ask them themselves. So primarily this work is about asking autistic young people, how do you feel about PE? Are you an attender? What is it you like about it? What is it you don't like about it? What kind of activities do you do in PE that you really like? What are the activities that you would really like to do that maybe you don't get to do? And so just really probing in a lot of different ways and with the whole range of questions, the perceptions of these young people. Esther, who might talk now if she'd like to contribute now, has been interviewing autistic young people, and she's spoken to 11 autistic young people so far to get their input, and she's had some really interesting input. These kids, it's not that they don't like physical activity, it's that there's a whole range of barriers that rear their heads when they come to try and access these things through school. And from Esther's work so far, and I must stress that she hasn't finalised this work yet. It'll be finalised within the next month or so. But I'm sure she'd be happy to share a few insights, particularly around uncertainty and sensory issues and choice as things that are coming up from these young people.
Wonderful. Esther, would you like to come in there and talk a little bit about your insight thus far with your youngsters?
Sure. So I'm a master's student at Durham University. I'm one of Mary's. Mary's just explained what I'm doing. So I did 11 interviews with autistic young people between the ages of 12 and 17. And I'm currently going through them and looking at common themes that come up again and again. And so Mary's described them. One of the things that's really come up over and over again, even for kids who love PE, has been uncertainty about activity. So a lot of anxiety, a lot of the students I've spoken to have been very anxious before their PE lesson, even if they're someone who might sometimes enjoy PE, because they don't know what's going to happen in their lesson. In other lessons, you often have a good idea of what's coming up, but in PE, you're affected by the weather, and sometimes by like what else is going on in sports hall on that day. And so the curriculum can be varied, and you don't necessarily know what to expect week to week, and that's something that can be really difficult for some of these students. And there is also just uncertainty in general, so uncertainty about PE kit, which again comes into that depending on the weather. So if you're outside, maybe then you're supposed to be wearing your leggings and you're worried that you may have forgotten your leggings. Also just generally being concerned about whether or not you have your PE kit, and whether or not, like, how it would be received if you have forgotten it. There's just a lot of anxiety and uncertainty, like also uncertainty of who you're going to be with. So if you're on a team, will you be choosing the team? Will the teacher be choosing the team? Will you have to wait to find out if someone is going to choose to pick you? These sorts of things are the things that I've heard coming up a lot from kids with uncertainty.
Yeah, and I mean, you've touched on at the very end there, Esther, about picking teams and the amount of times that comes up when we seek student voice across a lot of remits around participation, engagement, or health and wellbeing, or when we're looking around PSHE models, when we're thinking about what induces anxiety, or peer-to-peer induced anxiety relationship, friendship groups, all of that sort of thing. And picking teams in PE comes top ranked, number 10, produces the most anxiety every time. And yet we still don't seem to get it right or get that information translated across to coaching providers in particular, and often a lot of our schools and settings, that actually we need to think about those small little pedagogical approaches to our teaching and learning about how we actually just pick teams. There are so many structures and models to do. Our staff need to come on some of my CPD events, because there's just far more fun and engaging ways than having your peers pick teams, or doing it, you know, in supportive ways. Or actually, do we need to have their being a picking option? There's other ways of getting children involved in competitive sport, for instance, because that's also a switch off for many of our youngsters. Do our schools have too much competition, or for some, not enough? Because actually they often thrive in a team-related aspect as opposed to individual physical activity movements, or the other way around, depending on their sensory overloads and all of that. So there's so much more to be discussed with practitioners about what they can do to tweak their own practice that would have a significant impact on reducing the anxiety for many of our youngsters. Thanks, Esther. I get passionate about what we talk about and then I start to take over, so I will bring you all back in. Patrick, you're looking at the voice of autistic adults, and in particular women, is that correct?
Yeah, so since coming to the UK, it's been another kind of project that I've picked up, like Mary identified. The UK for physical activity and autistic children is particularly peculiar, because in the UK, autistic research is really strong across a lot of different areas. And so to me, when I noticed this trend, I was like, this is a bit shocking, to be honest. I didn't expect this kind of big gap. But one of the gaps that I did notice was this kind of forgotten generation and forgotten cohort of individuals, and autistic women in particular, who have maybe been diagnosed or misdiagnosed with other things. I mean, autism, even though it still has a higher diagnosis ratio in men than women, we do know that that is slightly biased. Our criteria might not be necessarily reflective of gender, and when it was developed, it came during a very gendered approach. So we have an entire cohort of individuals who, you know, have been kind of missed and forgotten. And so just speaking with autistic women in the Northeast especially, it's been really just eye-opening to not only, you know, learn about the barriers to physical activity, but also just wider society. And I think one of the things that keeps coming up doing adult-based research is, again, you know, we can't keep advocating for people to keep being more active, and we can't keep blaming people that they're not active enough. And we have this very value-laden blame approach on people as a society. And I think it doesn't help in any case for anyone to say that you're not active enough, or it's going to really make you really ill. We know in public health research that blaming messages don't work. And the autistic woman keeps saying, it's like, you know, we keep telling people this, but no one's listening. And to really support them, it's more than just saying, go out there, it's good for you. It's addressing the social barriers. So, for example, caregiving, where, you know, they might not have the space and the time to go and be physically active in a day where they have other caregiving responsibilities, especially if they have another child who is autistic, right? That's another value that's in their life, and they have to kind of work with, you know, what some of those parameters are. But again, our funding models and our kind of social supports don't necessarily always align with kind of what the needs are. So it's been really eye-opening again, just to kind of step back and see, well, what are we doing? How do we get to this point? And what do we need to do to move forward? And one of the things, again, that I say to move forward is to, you know, stop blaming people for not being active. And we know that to encourage someone, we all need to kind of take them along the journey, not put the journey on them. And that's just, again, a change in mindset that I think as a generation we're kind of coming to. The autistic woman I've also really said was kind of very prescriptive notion of physical activity. It must do this many minutes per day. For some people, that might work really well for them. For other autistic people, especially, it might become some of an obsession, and actually that might be debilitating, where they might get really hard on themselves if they didn't meet, let's say, 30 minutes today, or they didn't do their 30 sit-ups before bed, and that becomes actually very dangerous and debilitating for some people, where we know that there can be this intense fixation with certain things like that, right? So, again, it's been something to really grapple with, and one of the main kind of pieces that keeps coming up as well is again, just kind of debunking myths about physical activity, right? People assume right away that you got to go to the gym 4 times a week, or you have to, you know, look like a certain, have a certain body type, when we know that body type is not related to health in any way. So we have all these societal norms working together with Mary's working with the sensory world, working together with this with biology, and it's to marry all of those intersections together to really develop a better understanding of like what is really happening and then how do we move forward. And there's lots of work to be done everywhere across every sector. But I think especially in this cohort of autistic women who, like I said, have been kind of forgotten over the time of just the diagnostic period and how we've gotten to where we are today. So that project is almost done. We've had autistic women also kind of conduct interviews, and we've been very lucky to partner with two organizations who have been super helpful with not only helping us speak to women, but also build trust and relationships, because, you know, especially in the scientific world, we know that sometimes the autistic community has a hard time grappling with trust with scientists who may have used science for different purposes, if we think about some of the initial autism research. So I think we have, you know, a way forward with some researchers that, you know, feel comfortable with the autistic community and vice versa. So I think, again, half the same way to get someone to be physically active, you have to build that connection. I always say you've got to build a connection before correction when you're working with autistic people, period. And I think that's kind of an avenue that we have to kind of start to think about that way, rather than just pathologizing and blaming people for not meeting guidelines, but rather to work with their skills and what they can do versus what they can't. So that's been all from the woman, and it's been great to just kind of hear their insights. And especially again with another student of mine who also is autistic, and hearing her gendered experiences again of not being, you know, it's like, oh, you're a woman, you can't do that, you can't be a powerlifter, and she does it. And people are like, whoa, and you're autistic, that doesn't make sense. It's like, you know, all these stereotypical assumptions that are just, you know, really still pervasive in society. And not only is there a lot of work to be done with, like, it's a inclusive PE, but then myth busting and challenging stereotypes and norms and kind of reformulating what we think of, you know, what a healthy life looks like through physical activity. So definitely always something to do in this job. There's never enough research and efforts that need to be done at a bigger scale, right? Working at the individual level is important, but I think also then diversifying several our work, like Mary said, to the social level, to the structural level, to really kind of challenge some of our bigger social norms.
So I can imagine your piece of research has actually got a huge aspect of recommendations, much of which is about actually more research is needed within those looking at societal norms, looking at gender inclusivity or lack of equalities and all of that, because that insight from your females has provided a range of data there to use, not just in around the autistic field of research.
Yeah, and in my previous experience, especially working with kids, to bring us back to the school setting in PE, you know, there's a few different things that Dora mentioned, especially about being very anxious provoking and anxiety provoking before a class starts. So
yeah.
One small thing that we can do is literally, it sounds like so simple, and it is, because we might write out the schedule for the day, right? So today, you know, if we have a whiteboard in a gymnasium, it's like, okay, warm up, write what the warm up is, then say main activity, cool down. Even putting, walking in and having that ahead of time might help. If, I mean, this is a bit of a stretch sometimes for some teachers, to provide that ahead of time if any way possible, if you know exactly what you're going to be doing, you know, that small kind of preparation piece is a huge way to alleviate some of that anxiety and that unpredictability that can be, you know, really important. The favorite thing I like always to support teachers with is to provide, you know, this what I call a rule of three. And again, this carries over across different parts of education, but physical activity especially, where we don't want to be providing too much information all at once, right? We know it doesn't work. We don't want to say, come here, get dressed, do a run around. Like, you just forget it all and it becomes so overwhelming. So sticking to kind of three pieces of information, three instructions at one time, letting the task be executed, and then providing the next sense of instructions, again,
yeah.
It works really well for autistic children and youth. And for most kids, to be honest, they probably will benefit from that as well.
Yeah. And we have to be mindful of language and communication, don't we? And especially when you're thinking about that physical forum of instructions and that overload. So how we present and instruct, how we demonstrate is crucial. Thinking about children who are struggling with their verbal and nonverbal communication, of course. Mary, do you want to come in there with that around how we support children with those that language and communication aspect?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that rule of three that Patrick has shared is a real nugget, because it really does give teachers very simple and practical and easy to use way to approach giving that information out to autistic children and young people. And just to kind of also reiterate what Patrick says, that anything that can be done in advance to help with that preparation and reduce that uncertainty is really, really important. On the issue of language and communication, obviously there's no sort of one, I don't think there's any one strategy or tip that I could necessarily give, because obviously really it's about adapting the language and communication to the individual children and young people that you're working with. And we know that the whole variety of systems and visual communication approaches and toolkits that you can use to do that. But so I'm thinking about, you know, for autistic children and young people who may have few or no words, you're really thinking about using a picture-based communication system, I guess something like text or something like Makaton. But even for those kids who you know, who are sort of fluent fluent verbal communication and who appear to be very able in that respect, you still do need to think about the clarity of your communication. Are you meaning what you say and saying what you mean? You know, are you being clear, or is there sort of several different ways that you can interpret what you say or the instructions that you give? Because that lack of clarity and that ambiguity is again one of those things that can give rise to a lot of anxiety and to a lot of uncertainty. So simplicity, clarity of message, anything that you can give in advance to help reduce some of that uncertainty, and then adapting your communication style to the to the child or the young person that you're working with. But the only other thing to throw in the mix in terms of thinking about planning PE lessons, and Esther might like to come in here, is the element of choice and flexibility, because I don't think we've really spoken about that yet. And I think that is something that is coming from the testimonies of the young people that Esther's working with, the degree to which there could be choice and flexibility to adapt to some of the activities that these young people sort of may engage with more. So I know from Dora's work, for example, Dora asked a group of autistic young people what their favourite activities were and what their least favourite activities were. And there are some things coming through that, on average, the group of people Dora worked with really don't like. Rugby. Really don't like rugby. trampolining, really love trampolining. So it may be that for this neurodivergent group of children and young people, that there are some activities that they may benefit more from than neurotypical children and young people. And we really need to understand that, because that could be a really simple choice to offer that could work really well for a lot of autistic children and young people. And Esther, I don't know if you want to say something else about this issue of choice and what you've learned from the young people you've spoken to.
So I think the sort of key thing that I found is that most of the young people I spoke to, they all had a different individual sport that they preferred. So I think it really is, there's a lot of individuality, and you've got to talk to the students that you've got and work out what works for them. But a thing that a lot of people spoke about was that they liked their sort of favorite PE days, or like their ideal lesson. I asked each participant to explain to me about their ideal lesson. A lot of them, it would be when we get to do choices or options, and so there'd be several different PE activities set up and we could choose between them, and I could work, you know, alone if I wanted to, or I could work in a small group if I wanted to, but I'm not made to be in some big overwhelming contact sport, which many of the young people I spoke to, although not all of them, didn't like. And so that the idea of being able to have a choice in what you're doing, and then also choice in what you're wearing. There was a sort of overwhelming hatred for skorts. Really, really, really didn't like skorts. And feeling forced into a skort, especially for, I spoke to some young people who didn't necessarily identify as who were non-binary or who were gender fluid, and something like a skort, which is very gendered, is something that would make them feel very uncomfortable, but nonetheless, sometimes people can get very stuck on appropriate uniform, and that's how it's supposed to be, and that could be something that in one of the kids I spoke to that actually ended up preventing them from carrying on taking part in their PE lessons, which is quite sad. But yeah, so generally choice, with just like being flexible, just so that you can get someone through the door, is something that a lot of the young people I was talked about.
Thanks, Esther. Uniform is one, PE kit uniform is one aspect that has been heavily discussed around in our PE departments across the county, and thinking of what our students' perceptions of what they like and don't like and what's appropriate for them, especially when we're thinking about gender, and as you've talked about non-binary students as well, and having a voice. What comes across from all of this, isn't it, that actually we need to seek the motivations, opinions, perceptions from children and young adults, that actually they need to be heard, we need to listen. It's a school and settings priority, undoubtedly, that they need to seek the voice of youngsters. But action things accordingly. Often when we talk to students, they feel like there are student voice groups, ambassadorships, there's school councils, all of those set up, and they have their meetings, but often they're not necessarily seeing the action happening from whatever they've suggested or whatever they've divulged. So they don't feel like actually they've been heard or listened to, and it's almost lip service to it. So some of that will possibly, there will have been things happening, but it hasn't been shown as much, and it's been, you know, less obvious perhaps. But actually we need to make a big statement about actually your voice is heard. These are the actions. They need to be listened to from a very, very early stage in the co-creation of the curriculum changes that may occur. So when we're thinking about, as Mary talked about, trampolining, for instance, if that is going to now look and become part of that curriculum agenda for physical education, then what will it look like? Will the fact that it's mixed genders, for instance, or whatever, on the trampoline, is that going to cause issues for some of our students? Do they want it to be an option for some, or is it going to be part of a a stuck curriculum aspect that everyone will do, or will it be certain groups of children, so that actually often that is the case when they're in groups for certain activities that doesn't suit their needs. They often need to be able to make a choice on that too, which can be very difficult and challenging for schools, but equally something a small tweak or change may be very beneficial for the majority of students to have their voice heard and action to be taken to support it. It's all about being heard, isn't it? Thank you so much, all of you, for your time on this. It's most beneficial, and I'm sure that we'll open further discussions with the network of primary practitioners in our secondary schools and also our PE subject leads in our primary too. There's a vast amount of opportunity to disseminate a lot of this research with our schools and settings, but also for us to create further dialogue and forums and open up discussion further. When you're thinking about your research and your recommendations, we've talked about student voice there. Is there anything else that you feel that practitioners in schools need to know or need to be considerate of in providing an inclusive PE, school sport, and physical activity provision?
And I think there's just small adjustments that can go along the way, right? So again, when we think about, we already talked about sensory environment, right? So are we inside, are we outside? What is inconsistency in our routine? What are some of our norms and habits that we can kind of establish early on in the year? And like you've talked about, you know, it's not a top-down, you know, I'm the teacher, you're the student. We know that doesn't work very well. But to try and co-create that with the students and say, you know, we have the shared understanding of what our values and norms and rules are, and to have them kind of build that diversity and community of learners to actually have that space. You know, also working with a reward system often works really well. So even though, you know, our youth and children might not always have a choice for a reward, but to make it there. So when I was teaching, we'd always have Freedom Friday. So Friday was the day that they got to choose what activity they were doing. And so you kind of would have to adapt. Avoiding certain activities, for us, at least in Canada, dodgeball was still a very common activity that was extremely distressing to a lot of people, especially people who didn't have the coordination or motor skill abilities to catch a ball, throw a ball, get out of the way. So, you know, picking certain activities that we know that are going to cause more damage than benefit, you know, something that can be so simple can make a big way into kind of keeping someone active over life course, because we see both in the autistic and non-autistic population, individuals who are less active during childhood and adolescence are less likely to also be active in adulthood, right? So those early days and, you know, what I would even call trauma for some people, you know, that doesn't go away. Those scars do not heal. And we don't want to be doing that in a physical activity setting. In fact, we want people to be kind of lifelong learners of physical activity and people who find kind of meaning in movement. I mean, that's my new tagline, is finding meaning in movement. How we do that, especially in a school-based setting, you know, needs to be kind of done in tandem with teachers. Because, like, again, teachers are unsung heroes that have been asked to do a lot, especially last few years in the pandemic, whether it's teaching PE online, which I know some of my friends said it was the most horrible thing in the world. But to, again, just kind of reframe our general approaches that we might have grown up with. So again, at least in Canada, we had a very militaristic kind of style of PE with push-ups and fitness testing. And again, there might be value to that, but that shouldn't be our only way of teaching physical activity. So it's kind of checking our own assumptions, having that kind of ability to reflect on how we do things, why we do them, what value does it add, and how can we adapt things as we go forward. So,
and I think I'm just thinking about curriculum there, trampoline and what have you as well. And when you're thinking of children with autism and thinking about how they interpret signals from the senses, so they're in relation to bodies and movement. So if you've got kind of an undersensitivity to sensory senses, I'm not making sense, but you struggle, perhaps you are perceived to be clumsy, for instance, so that this proprioception and your vestibular system to do with your balance and what have you, or if you're oversensitive, you can you can struggle with your vestibular system and what have you. So things like dance and athletics and gymnastic based movement help support that. It helps support for every child and youngster. And we need to make sure that our curriculum has that breadth and balance. We don't go too heavily down that team organized sport route, or we don't go too heavy on the dance route that may switch off others and cause disengagement and all of that. It's about getting that balance, isn't it, to support every child. And in particular, sometimes having those intervention movement strategies for, in particular for our younger children, where we're thinking about sensory approaches to support the development of proprioception or the vestibular system, etc. It's quite crucial, really. So sometimes it's about an empowerment of the teaching staff to understand that and understand what misconceptions are around behaviour, clumsiness, and those labelled approaches that we kind of push out there, or society does, that actually, as Mary touched upon at the start, that everybody's individual and individuality should be celebrated. There isn't really a norm. We've all got our traits, tweaks and characteristics that should be celebrated across all fields. Mary, do you want to come in with anything that you feel is perhaps the recommendation from your studies and Esther's research as well that's coming out?
It's always tricky, and I always feel slightly uncomfortable when somebody asks me for recommendations around anything for a couple of different reasons. One is which I can't imagine how tough that is to be a teacher, as Patrick said, like a modern day educator, because the kind of demands that our teachers are under at the minute, I think are really hard to understand unless you're in the job. So I always feel a little bit uneasy about recommending things to teachers, because, you know, I'm always trying to understand. Like, it's all well and good for me to, it's very easy to hand out recommendations. It's much more difficult to actually put them in place in the systems that, that different people are working in. And the second thing is, when we're talking especially about neurodivergent children and young people, it's a phrase that you'll often hear in this line of work is, once you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. And that's really about the fact that, you know, we are all different. And when it comes to supporting autistic young people, yes, these young people may share certain similarities, but just like the rest of us, they're going to be so different to each other. So it's rarely the case that one recommendation is going to work for, you know, many different neurodivergent children and young people. So the one that I'm going to go with is not a recommendation for practice. It's about a training on understanding. You know, as a PE practitioner, you know, it's about sort of understanding all of the things that lie beneath the surface. So it's about understanding what those sensory experiences can be like. It's about understanding why so many autistic young people experience such high levels of anxiety, because it's really, you know, we can give a recommendation that might work for Mary, but won't work for Patrick. But if you understand, you know, Mary and Patrick's sensory differences and the reasons why they might be anxious, then you can tailor your own strategies and your own approaches to be individual to a whole range of different young people. So I guess that's what I would say, is that do what you can to engage in training around, you know, what lies beneath the surface, why autistic and neurodivergent young people can, you know, struggle with these particular issues or in these particular areas, because it's really armed with that understanding that you can develop your own practice and your own approaches and tailor those to suit a whole range of different people.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mary. And I guess that kind of wraps everything up, that actually having conversations like this is about that awareness raising and speaking to each other and sharing what works for us, what hasn't worked, and also providing that outlet as well, because as you've touched on there, teachers are under so much pressure from left, right, centre, all over, and to support every child and every child's need. We've got to pat ourselves on the back sometimes to recognise what we manage to do amongst the pressures across everything within education, and providing that pastoral care for our youngsters in particular too. So yeah, it's about sharing dialogue, because we've also got to think about our own mental health and well-being, and often that is about speaking more, talking more. I'm a good talker, as you know. And there you go. So I'm going to wrap up here. We've talked forever. This is a really long podcast, and I'm so happy to have had you engage with our listeners today. Thank you to Esther, who was on the call with us today. Thanks, Dr. Patrick and Dr. Mary. It's been most valuable to have you with us today. So do, listeners, look out for our podcasts coming more fluid and to you quickly. We've got lots of new guests on my list to speak to, and I'm sure we will also invite Esther and Patrick and Mary to speak to us again. Many thanks for your time.